Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's day five of the hunger strike in California's prisons. On Monday, 30,000 inmates in 22 of the state's 33 prisons and four out-of-state prisons where California inmates are sent refused to eat to protest long-term confinement in special housing units or the SHU. The SHU is a very small cell where prisoners are confined for at least 22 hours a day. Many are placed there indefinitely. Many prisoners refer to the SHU as a, quote, living coffin. While conditions inside the SHU are being widely reported, the big question is, how are reporters supposed to cover prisons if they have a difficult time getting past the gates? Nearly one in 100 Americans are incarcerated in the United States. One in 100. In a Columbia Journalism Review piece about the difficulties covering prisons, Ted Guest, president of the Criminal Justice Journalists, say there are a half a dozen reporters across the country covering prisons, and some of them cover other issues as well. He said, quote, "It's never been perceived as that newsworthy. Most prisons, unless there's a lot going on like a riot, just are not considered that sexy," unquote. So how do reporters deal with these difficulties to try to get the real story out about what goes on behind closed doors? And then also, when we're talking about the hunger strike in California, who's asking the larger questions? How should prisoners be treated? That's one of the big questions that we're going to talk about on today's show. Nancy Mullane is executive producer of Life of the Law, a national radio program that looks at law in society. She has covered prisons for the past 7 years. She's the only reporter in the country who's managed to gain access to San Quentin's Death Row's protective housing unit. She's also gone inside SHU cells at Pelican Bay, which is near the Oregon border, up north in California. Nancy is author of the book Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. And Nancy is back in the studio. Hi, Nancy. Thank you so much for coming back.
Hi, Rose. Thanks.
And we are joined by Corey Johnson, investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can read his latest investigation called Female Inmates Sterilized in California Prisons Without Approval at CIR.org. We also have a link to it on our website. And just to give you an idea of what this piece is about, it's being shared widely on Facebook. It begins by saying that doctors under contract with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation sterilized nearly 150 female inmates from 2006 to 2010 without required state approvals, the Center for Investigative Reporting has found. At least 148 women received tubal ligations, thank you, in violation of prison rules during those 5 years, and there are perhaps 100 more dating back to the late 1990s, according to state documents and interviews. And Carrie Johnson is an investigative reporter with the center. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you.
Yes, it's great to be here.
And we are also joined by James Ridgway. James founded Solitary Watch 3 years ago. Solitary Watch is a web-based project aimed at bringing the widespread use of solitary confinement out of the shadows and into the light of the public sphere. Their mission is to provide the public, as well as attorneys, scholars, law enforcement, and correction officers, with the first centralized source of unfolding news, firsthand accounts, and background research on solitary confinement in the United States. James is former senior Washington correspondent for Mother Jones. In 1965, he revealed that General Motors had hired private spies to spy on an obscure consumer advocate named Ralph Nader. He worked for many years at the Village Voice and is the author of 16 books, including The Five Unanswered Questions About 9/11. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for asking me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give reporters who did a good job this week some praise for their work. So, Nancy, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to start with the program that I actually produce. It's called Life of the Law. And we had a reporter named Stephanie Hughes do a report that she worked on for a few months. It's called Redefining Rape. And what we look at is the use of the word rape in the courts throughout the United States. Beginning in the 1970s, the word rape began to be changed over to criminal sexual conduct with the hope that that would result in more convictions. And as we found in the story, that has not happened. But what has happened is in 25 states throughout the United States, the word rape is no longer used to identify what many women and men experience when they're sexually assaulted.
So what changes are you seeing in terms of how to define rape?
Well, one of the things is in many states, anal, oral, and vaginal rape are all identified differently. So in New York State, for example, the only sexual assault that is that is considered a rape is a vaginal rape. Anything else is considered sexual assault. So and it changes throughout the country by the state that you look at. So what we're looking at is there was an attempt in New York to go back to the use of rape representing all of these different kinds of sexual assault. And that did not pass. But one of the individuals who supports that was a woman who was raped in all three manners, and how she felt that she could not identify what had actually happened to her in the court. And she was they actually found the perpetrator guilty of the anal and oral, but not the vaginal. And so it's like, how do we approach rape in our society? And what does that word really mean?
Yeah,
it was an interesting report.
Yeah, and we actually got a few questions yesterday. We spent the hour talking about the hunger strike in California. We got a few emails about rape in prisons. We weren't able to get to that, but we definitely will today because all of you have been focusing on this. And James had a piece in Mother Jones about America's 10 worst prisons. And so many of in these prisons deal with rape. So we're going to talk about that today. And we'll also put a link to the story you mentioned at yourcallradio.org. And Corey, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There's a story that ran in the New York Times by a fabulous reporter by the name of Ron Nixon called U.S. Postal Service Logging All Mail for Law Enforcement. Mm. And what the story is about, it's been very well known and common now that the National Security Agency has been sucking up, you know, a wide array of our phone calls, cell phones, texts, and internet exchanges. But what Nixon uncovered was that after the anthrax scare, the Postal Service entered into this program called the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program, where every single piece of mail that's processed in the United States, which is roughly about 160 billion pieces of mail, the post office is photographing and storing those images so that law enforcement can gather it up and be able to monitor and track and carry out law enforcement activities. And so the story not only highlights a couple cases that law enforcement has used by getting this mail, and the key point is law enforcement doesn't have to go to a judge to get a warrant to get these images of your mail. All they have to do is ask the Postal Service, and the Postal Service turns it over to them pretty routinely. So I thought that was a fascinating story, and the way the reporter entered into the story, he was able to find a guy who owned a bookstore who considers himself an activist but had been on the FBI kind of watch list back in the 70s, but, you know, went on and changed his life and, you know, he was pretty settled. But the guy discovered by accident where one of the notes where one of the post office supervisors had asked an employee to make sure that he copy all this guy's mail was left by mistake on the bookstore owner's card, and so once he saw it, it tipped off him to this program, and that's how the reporter was able to unravel the program through this one bookstore owner who discovered by accident that his mail was being copied routinely.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, we're going to have to do a show because so much new information is coming out about surveillance and spying, and it's really hard to keep up. So thank you so much for that, Corey, and we'll add a link to that report right after the show. And what about you, James? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You mean about prisons?
It can be about anything. We just like to give kudos to reporters who do good jobs because there's a lot of media criticism out there, but there's a lot of good stuff that doesn't really get the attention it deserves.
Oh, dear, I don't know. I think the hunger strike is a big... Look, I just follow this prison stuff, so I'm not much use to you in this.
All right, well, where are you seeing good and extensive coverage of prisons in this country?
Well, I don't see any.
None?
I really haven't seen any, no. I've seen bits and pieces here and there. I mean, the National Geographic did a very interesting thing about Colorado. But there isn't one. I mean, I don't know what goes on in California, but we just ran an article. We have an intern named Sal Rodriguez who's covered this hunger strike for several years now. And he dug up these documents that the California health people have, saying that, among other things, that during this hunger strike, there can be a situation where you don't have to revive the person who's been striking, in other words, who's near death. It seems to me they're looking for a very long hunger strike, and they're probably going to face deaths. Now, I don't know whether that kind of thing is reported in California or not.
It's getting a brief mention, Nancy. Have you seen that in much reporting?
What I have seen, I haven't seen that in the reporting. I've just seen mentions that it could go on for weeks.
Right.
But I have not seen the only area that I've seen identified where they're how the CDCR is going to approach individuals who are extensively involved in the hunger strike and how they might go into arrest is that they're going to the medical receiver's office for the CDCR. The press office in Sacramento for the CDCR announced that if, or at least told me in a conversation that I had with them, that if the person does go into some kind of arrest or they need to be resuscitated, that they'll be looking at whether or not they have a power of attorney or if they have do not resuscitate orders in their file, that they're going to be assigning medical personnel to oversee anyone who is involved in the hunger strike that has now gone. In fact, they just announced yesterday afternoon that 12,421 inmates in the state of California are now officially on hunger strike. That means they have gone 9 consecutive meals without taking food, officially from state-sponsored food. Whether or not they have canteen food in their cells is a question. That's representing 24 prisons. And in addition, I just noticed in their email that they put out yesterday as a press release that they are also considering going into the cells of those 12,421 and removing any canteen food so that if they say they're on a hunger strike and they're officially represented as on a hunger strike, that they don't have canteen food. So whether or not they have medical personnel right now watching these individuals and how they're going to address it if this hunger strike is extended has not been addressed.
Are they going to face a backlash? And if they do, how will reporters get this information?
Well, the backlash information or what will happen to individuals who are incarcerated in California's prisons who do choose to participate in the hunger strike officially, what will happen is they will be held accountable in terms of the CDCR's official standards of conduct. So if they participate, quote, in a mass disturbance, and this is considered by the CDCR to be a mass disturbance, or if they refuse to participate in their work assignments. So many life inmates have work assignments. They work 9 to 5 or they work 7 to 3 every day.
Is it true that they make about 13 cents an hour?
They do make that, but they don't get all of that. And there are varying degrees of employment, how much they're paid, depending on what the job is. But if they do get 15 cents an hour, they don't really receive all that 15 cents directly. Some of it goes to victims restitution, like 5 cents goes here, 5 cents goes there, 5 cents goes to their canteen budget that we were just talking about. But if they do refuse to participate in their work assignment, and apparently 1,336 inmates in California have now joined the hunger strike and are refusing to participate in their work assignment. So either whether they participate in what's called the mass disturbance or they refuse their work assignments as part of the hunger strike, those can be That can result in official discipline. So that might mean what they receive is maybe a 115, which is a disciplinary write-up, which goes in their official folder. It can or a file. It's called a C file. It can also mean being identified by the CDCR as now involved in gang activity, because the hunger strike is seen as being in some way orchestrated by some of the gang affiliated leaders. So This could result, A, in them having, if they're a life term inmate with a possibility of parole, that means they're going to be going before the parole board. Having a 115 in your C file when you go before the board could mean you are not found suitable for parole. The other issue is if they are, in fact, identified as having gang affiliation as a result of being involved in the hunger strike, that could result in them being put in a security housing unit. Which, if they're not already in a security housing unit, that could be a result.
You know, I want to step back and talk about prison reporting more broadly, because Columbia Journalism Review has a great story called Inside Stories. Nearly one in 100 Americans is incarcerated. But how well can journalists cover prisons if they can't get past the gates? And this piece is really interesting because it looks at all these different laws and states. In Alabama, you can do things that you can't do in Illinois. And Corey, can you just talk a little bit about, you know, what is it like for you to try to get access? I mean, you just wrote this explosive piece, Female Inmates Sterilized in California Prisons Without Approval. What has been your experience in trying to get inside prisons?
It's the toughest reporting I've ever done in my life. And that's saying a lot, because I've done a ton of different investigations, and I've never had the trouble that I did on this one, largely because of what the CJR article points out, that and particularly in California, that they are pretty closed. I mean, there is some access, but the route that you have to take in order to get access it can be very, very difficult. And the prison, CDCR, tends to have a reputation, if they think it's a story that might be critical, to really throw up even more roadblocks. I faced a lot of roadblocks and a lot of difficulty trying to get information from them. That being said, I had to cast my net, and I would imagine other reporters as well, with family members, advocates, people who were formerly incarcerated, who still keep in contact with people on the inside. And through that network, there is opportunity to be able to begin to get information outside of the prison. But even that can be very difficult, because a lot of former inmates and a lot of family members are very wary of the press, just like the general theme in the populace right now is to be somewhat suspicious of the press. And so it really takes a lot of time, a lot of trust building in order to be able to get that kind of access. And it's very difficult. I mean, I was fortunate in that my bosses gave me the time to be able to do this. But in many, many newsrooms, there just isn't that kind of will to be able to give reporters time to overcome these kind of obstacles. And so there are stories that need to come out of the prison. But because of these dynamics, there is so much more that people don't know, because the journalism just can't crack the nut.
When you think about the fact that we've got 2.3 million people locked up in 1,800 prisons and 3,000 jails, billions of dollars in most states, the prisons are almost their highest when it comes to the budget, right next to Medicare. Or Medicaid, I should say. This is according to a 2009 study by the Pew Center. Here in California, the Columbia Journalism Review pointed out that California allows tours but does not grant requests for interviews with specific inmates. Governor Brown recently vetoed a bill that would have allowed greater media access to prisons, the ninth time a California governor has done so in the last 20 years.
Yeah, Corey, this is Nancy Mullane. I just want to say what an amazing report you have provided to everyone. I read your report and I just wanted to ask you, as a prison reporter, I wanted to say, how did you get that? It's just extraordinary reporting, and I have great respect for what you've just accomplished.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I really appreciate it. And likewise, it was a labor of love, but I also told my mom, I just said, shoot me when this is over with, because I don't know if I can take it. I mean, it's very, very difficult. I got some good breaks later in the process, but it took me many, many months. But for my story, the process started actually with very innocuously. I was watching CNN one Sunday afternoon, and there was a report on eugenics in America. And for people who don't know or that term, eugenics was a time in America where states were forcibly sterilizing the poor, minorities, criminals, and anyone else who was deemed undesirable, under the thought or the premise that these bad genes were a threat to society, and that they needed to, in order for society to flourish and grow, you needed to restrict these horrible or less desirable genes. And what made the CNN piece eye-opening for me, I'm originally from the South and have worked as a reporter in North Carolina, and so I was somewhat familiar with the eugenics program in North Carolina. But the CNN piece shed light on the Golden State, California's past. And when it highlighted that California was the leader in eugenics and that the Nazis had consulted with California in the construction of the Nazi Germany's eugenics program, that really grabbed me. And from that point on, I began to want to dig into, and I did start to dig into eugenics just on a whim of curiosity to want to know more about California's role. And as I was doing that, I came across a tip that perhaps more recent, questionable at a minimum, coercive at a maximum sterilizations had occurred in the prisons within the last 3 or 4 years. And so after getting the tip, that's when I began to try to consult and cast the net out to people inside the government, outside the government, and the advocacy groups to see who knew about this. And at some point I was able to get some data that indeed confirmed that that the CDCR had been reimbursing the doctors to carry out these procedures so that the procedures have been done. And that was the genesis of digging into this story to try to learn more about what happened.
And that is Corey Johnson, investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He came out with an explosive piece about doctors under contract with the department sterilized nearly 150 female inmates from 2006 to 2010 without state approvals. And we've got some quotes from some of the doctors who did this, and I'll read a few right after the break. We're also joined by James Ridgway. He founded Solitary Watch 3 years ago to try to publicize what prisoners go through in solitary confinement. We'll talk with James about his piece, America's 10 Worst Prisons, right after the break. And Nancy Mullane is executive producer of Life of the Law, a national radio program that looks at law in society. She's covered prisons for 7 years. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
All All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin about the city's foreclosure problems and solutions. Richmond might become the nation's first city to use eminent domain to bail out distressed homeowners. So what is the state of the foreclosure crisis today? And then on Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about the value of getting a college degree. How has the increase in the cost of a degree affected poor and middle-class young people? What are they facing? What are they thinking about right now, as it's so incredibly difficult to get a job? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the state of prison reporting. The prison strike in California is getting widespread attention, but it's so focused just on the state of California. There's barely a mention that 2.3 million Americans are locked up in 1,800 prisons and 3,000 jails across the country. That's one in 100 Americans. And then what about isolation? It's hard to get a real count, but many estimates say just over 81,000 prisoners are held in some form of isolation in state and federal prisons. So we're talking about the state of prison reporting today with Nancy Mullane, executive producer of Life of the Law, a national radio program that looks at law and society. She's the only reporter in the country who's managed to gain access to San Quentin's Death Row's protective housing unit. She's also gone inside shoe cells at Pelican Bay up north. She's author of the book Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. Corey Johnson is an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. His investigation, which took many months, is called Female Inmates Sterilized in California Prisons Without Approval. James Ridgway founded Solitary Watch 3 years ago to highlight the conditions in solitary confinement. He's a former senior Washington correspondent with Mother Jones. And James, I wanted to also talk with you about your incredible essay, many essays, America's 10 Worst Prisons. And you took a look at life inside, frankly, prisons that most of us have never heard of. There's one prison, I just want to use a couple examples. Julia Tutwiler Prison in Wetumpka, Alabama. Prisoners fear that, quote, it's not safe to take a shower. It's not safe to go to sleep. You can be manipulated into sexual favors. It's very horrific. This is a prison that holds 400 women. You also looked at Walnut Grove, which is in Leake County, Mississippi. Quote, a picture of such horror as should be unrealized anywhere in the civilized world. Can you talk about how you came up with the idea to write about the 10 worst prisons in the United States?
Well, it's hard to explain, really, because, I mean, that's all we do is one prison after another. And I do all my reporting now basically with prisoners. I essentially use prisoners in a funny kind of way as reporters. So I work with prisoners and their families. I kind of got exhausted trying to deal with the mainstream press, and I can't get anywhere usually with lawyers who won't talk to you. And the corrections people sometimes are helpful, but mostly not. So I'm in correspondence. I mean, I'm looking here at maybe 25 letters I haven't opened this morning. Mm-hmm. From people in various parts of the country. And some of them are, you know, which people would say are wackos, and some of them clearly aren't. And then I go into the cases like a lawyer would. I try to go right into the cases and find out what's going on. And it's just sort of like so upsetting that on the one hand, you don't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you're kind of like outraged. And on the other hand, you kind of want to give up, you know? And so these 10 worst prisons are pretty well known. The Tutwiler thing is part of was the end all, be all of a big ACLU prison project suit. And there, you know, it's like a lot of prisons that rape, whatever you want to call it, rape is what it is. Guards just rape the women. Mm. Women have their children. And one of the things that that happens in prisons is that when something like this happens, you'll have one of the employees, either the woman or maybe the male guard, will put in for money, actually. And so you have payments from the state to support this kind of behavior. I think in New York State it's several million dollars. This kind of thing goes on all over the place. And, you know, I deal with deaf prisoners a lot who are constantly being raped. Mm. And, like, the deaf prisoner will go down and he'll sit with a blind prisoner, and he'll help the blind prisoner by waking the cockroaches off his food. And the blind prisoner will sometimes help the deaf prisoner, you know, write a letter or talk to his parents or something. Mm. And then the blind prisoner will extort for the deaf prisoner. And then the guard will rape, or a gang will rape the deaf prisoner. Mm. And it's just every day, one thing after another. The problem in the United States is not these small-time regulations. What the problem is that there is no defense system for people who don't have any money. Mm-hmm. There simply doesn't exist. And people who go along and, you know, I know lawyers have to talk about these things, but one case after another, there is just no legal defense of any kind. Mm. It's just simply a plea bargain off the top of your head, you know. And half the people in solitary are in for nonviolent crimes. Mm. One-third are mentally ill. Mm. What happens to the guy that I'm dealing with now who threatened to kill himself this morning? He's mentally ill, tried to kill himself since he's 5 years old. So he gets in a fight with a cop when he gets out of one of these institutions, and he then is put in prison for a couple of years, and they throw him into medical solitary. Mm. Now, in New York State, there's a law which is supposed to keep people who are mentally ill out of solitary. But so, irrespective of this law, this guy is put in medical solitary. And what does he try to do? Guess. He tries to burn his cell down to kill himself. Mm. So what does the prison do? They don't try to deal with him inside that prison. They take him back to Utica, New York, the city he came from, and they put him before a grand jury, a regular grand jury, and they indict him for arson. And then they plea bargain that, and they say, put him in, I don't know, for 6 years or something. And then the guy says, he's illiterate, you know? He can barely write. I send him Looney Tunes comic books. And he asked for a Bible the other day.
Wow.
And so, okay, so what happens to him? He says he wants to appeal this thing, which he doesn't understand. No one has ever talked. He never even talked to the public defender who plea bargained him. His mother wasn't able to talk to him. When they plea bargained him into 6 years or whatever, and she told the guy that he was mentally ill, the guy laughed at her. This is a defense lawyer. Okay, so now he wants to appeal himself. So now he gets this letter, which I could barely understand, which tells him about the process of appeal. And it says, well, if you succeed in your appeal, just remember, you're probably going to get tried again and you're going to get a worse sentence. Mm. So, like, you tell me that there are all these rules and everything. There aren't any rules. The thing is, these guys are totally screwed from the word go.
But there are rules, and the rules that exist actually prevent the press from getting access in many cases to inmates. Once an inmate is taken behind the walls of a California state prison, they really lose their constitutional rights to freedom of the press or freedom to speak to the press. Because, for instance, for the last 7 years, if I discovered very early on that if I wanted to speak to an inmate in a California prison, I could not say their name. I would have to say, I want to speak to an inmate who has been in for 2 years, is serving this kind of a sentence. And then if you are approved to go behind the walls of a prison as a member of the press, A, you can never have gone to the prison to visit inmate by as a visitor. If you ever have gone to visit an inmate as a visitor and as a member of the press, you are excluded from ever going inside a California prison again. So you have to only go in under the with a public information officer from the prison, who then gives you what's called random access to an inmate. You can't ask to speak to an inmate by name or by their CDC number. And so over the years, I've found ways to ask for more and more specific kind of inmate to try and get access to do stories about inmates in California prisons, which is an $11 billion a year industry with 130,000 inmates at 33 institutions. When you mentioned at the beginning that I had exclusive access to inside California's death row that no one has ever been in, that's not true. I'm the only one who have been in the California death row in a decade. And I am the only reporter to go inside the protective housing unit at Corcoran State Prison, where they keep inmates in such an exclusive environment that they don't even announce what prisoners are there. No one is supposed to know who's there. I know that Charlie Manson is there, and there's a few other inmates I can't name. But getting inside death row of San Quentin was an extraordinary process. It took me all of the 6 years prior to get in. I had to be approved by the secretary of the CDCR at the time, Matthew Cate, who I had to sit across the table from and ask him directly to give me access. And when you talk about this, you know, and it is it by law that press are not guaranteed access in California prisons. It's called the Title 15 Code of California's regulations that restricts reporters' access to the safety and security of the institution. So it's all random. But going inside death row, which I felt was, you know, what I said to the Secretary of the State, Secretary of the CDCR, Matthew Cate, was if you don't allow a member of the press to go inside death row for a decade, it's as if we have a Guantanamo Bay right here, a half hour north of San Francisco, and we accept that that is happening. And getting inside to the three different death rows was an extraordinary experience, because here we have, just in that one prison, we have 700 and approximately, depending on the day, 711 inmates living in these environments with no access to the press. So one of the men that I met inside this San Quentin's East Block was visually impaired because he was so depressed on death row that he tried to kill himself by puncturing his eyes out with Bic pens to try and reach his brain. He was not successful, which left him blind and paralyzed. But then I was sitting at my desk two months ago, and I got an email that he had actually been successful. Now, if I hadn't spoken to him, where he just talked about his feelings of remorse for what he had done and how badly he felt for and took full responsibility for what he had done, and if he hadn't had an opportunity to share that, then the person who actually notified me that he had successfully killed himself, which was a survivor's victim of the people he had killed, she said, I would never have known that he actually took responsibility for the crimes that he committed, which was part of this process of what we send people to prison for, is we want to know what happens. Were they punished? Did they rehabilitate themselves? But by restricting the press's access to these environments, we're also restricting the society's access to information.
That is Nancy Mullane, executive producer of Life of the Law, a national radio show that looks at law and society. She's author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. James Ridgway founded Solitary Watch 3 years ago to give the public information about what actually goes on behind closed doors. He's a former senior Washington correspondent with Mother Jones. Corey Johnson is an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. His latest piece, Female Inmates Sterilized in California Prisons Without Approval. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We're talking about the state of reporting today. Ted Guest, president of the Criminal Justice Journalist, says there are about six reporters in the country covering prisons, and they work on other issues as well. He says, quote, it's never been perceived as that newsworthy. Do you agree with that? And why is that? Because when you think about how many people are in prison, 2.3 million, one out of 100, why aren't we getting more stories about what Nancy just talked about America's 10 worst prisons, about women being sterilized? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Just quickly, James, you brought up something interesting that half of inmates in solitary are in for nonviolent offenses. A third are mentally ill. In the majority of the reporting I've read in California, we're not really getting much information about who these people are, why they're in the SHU. And one of the more disturbing, I mean, all of the 10 prisons are disturbing, but you write about the U.S. Penitentiary Administrative Maximum in Florence, Colorado. And you write about this guy, Jack Powers, who is convicted. He's a convicted bank robber who landed at ADX after escaping from another prison. According to his lawsuit, quote, he had no history of symptoms or serious mental illness when he arrived 11 years ago. In addition to repeated suicide attempts, he removed one of his testicles, bit off a finger, and amputated another one. I mean, the guy is in there for bank robbery and escaping from another prison? And why don't we know more about this, about why these people are in for solitary? And I just assumed most of them were in there for murder.
Well, they probably are, most of them, for murder. But, I mean, I write to people who are escape artists all the time. Guy was 144 years because he embarrassed the state of Texas. He got out. He was an embezzler or something. He didn't do anything except embezzle. Small-time embezzler, by the way. 144 years. And there's several, there are people in for, you know, assault and so on, but A lot of people, the people we deal with, the people I deal with, are criminals. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are never going to get out. And I deal with these people in the hopes that they get humane treatment. I mean, you know, and this idea, for example, that goes down to these prisons somehow are rehabilitative facilities, which is always in their name, you know, the correctional facility, is a joke. These guys in shoes in New York State, for example, they just sit there. They don't do anything. They just sit there year after year. I write with a guy, I'm friends with a guy who killed a cop, and he's been in 26 years in solitary. 26 years. He's a writer. He's a gifted writer. And he didn't do anything. He just watches the cockroaches. He counts the cockroaches at night. One time, he sometimes goes outside, like once every two or three years. There's a guy in Colorado, in the Colorado State Penitentiary, who didn't see the sun for 10 years.
Wow.
He was mentally ill, but he was considered to be dangerous. It's just like the thing is, you got to realize this system is so impenetrable. Like by dealing with prisoners and by their families, you can get quite a bit of information. But I have toyed with the idea of really trying to sue to get press access and one place or another, but I'm always told by the lawyers that it's a waste of time, you'll never go anywhere. So I don't know quite what to do, short of a WikiLeaks, which obviously I'm not going to get involved with. But I mean, I don't know how to break this. I really don't.
I think it takes a great amount of time and energy to build that relationship with an institution so that they have, you know, they know that they've kind of got you on their, you know, you're being watched the whole time you're in. And I find that when I did four stories on prisons when I began, I was asked by one of my national editors, I won't mention the program, was I becoming an advocate for prisoners because I was reporting on prison. I was suggesting a fifth story on prisons. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of time and effort and getting a fellowship. I was given a fellowship to do reporting so that I could devote time for 2 years to just doing prison reporting. It's you know, there isn't a lot of funding. There isn't a lot of support by editors to do. KLW has given me extraordinary support to do prison reporting over the last 6 years. But it's rare. Yeah. It's extremely rare.
And Corey, we're getting some questions about your piece about female inmates sterilized. What were these women in prison for?
Well, a whole host of, I mean, they all run the gamut, but I have to say that we're very, very proud of the story, but the story still just scratches the surface, and there's so much that we don't know, which is one of the reasons why on the piece, and as many opportunities that I can do it, I'm trying to encourage people who know about this program, who either worked inside of the prisons, worked in the hospitals, or had this happen to them, or had a family member who experienced this, to please come forth to talk to me more about it so I can get a better sense of who these women are. There was a lot of secrecy that's covering what happened here. Some of it is legitimate medical privacy, and some of it is just, you know, the whole context of the prison culture being very guarded, being very secret. And one of the learning lessons for me when I had a chance to meet some of the women, there are women that I talk to who still don't want to publicly air their stories because of a lot of trauma that they experience and a lot of shame. Mm. What was explained to me was, you know, you commit a crime, you make a horrible mistake. You go in, you're separated from, you know, your family, your loved ones. You're in a horrible condition because at that time period, there was a lot of overcrowding. So you would have 8 women in a cell, which was only really made to house 4 people. And so you're dealing with all of that. You're dealing with just the environment, and you're pregnant. And then you have a doctor or doctors wanting to sterilize you. And maybe you do it, maybe you don't. But then let's say you do. Let's say you decide that you are going to get a tubal ligation. You get out. Your life gets better. You get a job. You start trying to rebuild your connections. And you meet a man or you meet a partner and you want to start a family, but now you can't because years ago when you were in prison, somebody, you know, came to you, and in that environment, you know, that was taken from you. And so a lot of the women, once they explained that to me, they wanted me to know why it's so difficult for them to talk about it and why it's such an important thing to know, but it's also very, very hard to get at.
We had a caller, Jerry, who couldn't stand the line, Corey, and he says, is there any way to publicize the names of the doctors? And in your piece, the one former Valley State inmate who gave birth to a son in October 2006 told you that the prison's OBGYN, Dr. James Heinrich, repeatedly pressured her to agree to be sterilized. You interviewed Dr. Heinrich. From 97 to 2010, the state paid doctors over $147,000. He told you that it wasn't a huge amount of money to spend over 10 years. He said, quote, compared to what you save in welfare, paying for these unwanted children as they procreated more, end quote. That's kind of an explosive thing to say. And then the other thing is you interviewed Christina Cordero, 34. She spent 2 years in prison for auto theft. Quote, as soon as he found out that I had 5 kids, he suggested that I look into getting it done. The closer I got to my due date, the more he talked about it. He made me feel like a bad mother if I didn't do it, end quote. Where is this doctor now?
The doctor is, you know, he still resides in the Bay Area. The federal court that has oversight over this issue say that he's no longer with the system. But in some documentation, they still had him listed as a contractor, so it's not quite clear his status. When I talked to him, he was, you know, he and his former supervisor, Don Martin, who's also in the story, they were very passionate that they thought that these tubal ligations were necessary and good. But one of the key things in the story that I would want people to know is Martin acknowledged that they knew the rules. They knew that there was a ban, and they just decided to breach this ban. They decided to find ways around it. And one of the ways they came up with was to try to justify it as a medical emergency. So in Heinrich's tale to me, a woman that had 3 or more C-sections could be at risk for this emergency. And so that's why he pitched it to him. He would say, I didn't ask anybody unless they have 3 C-sections or more, and I had to tell them or else I would be at risk. But what I found when I actually interviewed some of the women who talked about being asked repeatedly and repeatedly, they asked them, I said, well, how many C-sections did you have? Oh, I only had one. Or how many? I never had a C-section, and they were asking. And so there seemed to be some strong contradictions just at that level. And then a medical expert told us quite succinctly that 3 C-sections is not an indication of a type of risk that you would solve by permanent sterilization. That's just something that she said is not appropriate to offer for women in those kind of circumstances.
And Corey, I wish we had another hour because we're getting so many emails. People say, how has the prison industrial complex gotten this out of hand and what can be done about this? James, do you think, I mean, with Corey's reporting, this is getting so much attention. The state has to respond. Can these investigations lead to any change?
Well, I mean, they don't seem to have in the past. I mean, maybe, I mean, I'm very suspicious of the effect of the press. I'm not sure it leads to anything. I think, on the basis of my very, very limited experience, that the single most important way of changing the prison system is for the prisoners and their families and for the public to get in connection with each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can get the public, the general public, to write prisoners, because that's the only way you can get any information. Mm. You can write prisoners, and they can write you.
Wow.
Even though, you know, periodically, like the people I write to, they take their stamps away, they don't have any money, blah, blah. But that does happen, and the courts have permitted that. And I think that does start to change it. I think all these legal, you know, efforts to modify legislation and so on go on and on and on and on, and I don't know. I mean, if you ask a family of somebody who's in prison about this stuff, you know, it's just despair.
Mm.
It'll go on forever. And these suits, like the suits involving the Angola 3, I mean, the guy's dying of cancer. One of them's dying of cancer. He was misdiagnosed in the prison infirmary. You know, they thought he had some fungus on his stomach when he actually had liver cancer. So he's dying of cancer. He's sitting in his cell at 96 degrees. You know, they finally managed to get him out of the cell and put him in a prison hospital room of some kind. The guy's been in solitary for 41 years. 41 years. And, you know, and they've got case after case, man. They've got lots of law cases in this thing. And we don't want to talk about that because it might upset the law case.
Well, and, you know, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to do another show because we need more time. As you said, James, a lot of this goes back to poverty. And the question no one's asking is, how should these people be treated? James Ridgway founded Solitary Watch 3 years ago. Find his America's 10 Worst Prisons report at our website. Nancy Mullane is executive producer of Life of the Law, author of Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption. Carrie Johnson is an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Find his piece about female inmates being sterilized in California prisons. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What are local solutions to help homeowners threatened with foreclosures? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin about the city's foreclosures problems and solutions. Richmond could become the nation's first city to use eminent domain to bail out distressed homeowners. What is the state of foreclosures today? The worst of the crisis is over, but many problems remain. What resources are available to homeowners facing foreclosures? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.